Welcome to Linux Journal Insider, issue number 206. This is the embedded issue for June 2011. Hey, Kyle, how are you doing?
Hey, how's it going? I'm doing pretty good here. It's springtime.
It is springtime. Although I have to tell you, yesterday we actually had a snow day here. I work at a school, and we had a snow day here in northern Michigan. It was sunny and warm the day before, and then overnight we got 8 inches of snow.
Wow. Is that why it's like the middle finger of Michigan, or is it?
Pretty much, yeah. And actually, not to get too GPS on you, I live right about in the fingernail of the middle finger of Michigan. So that's right where I live. And then today it was sunny and warm, and all the snow is gone. It's the craziest thing. But we got a snow day, so during snow days I get to play around. And I got to play around with this new thin client. Well, it's not really a thin client. It's actually a workstation, but it was donated to the school. It's the first of many. And something really cool that actually is happening, every so often at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., they actually rotate their technology. They, like, have a tech client, and they – yeah, I know, right? And they rotate stuff, and when they get rid of it, it's actually cheaper for them to donate the stuff to organizations that need it than it is for them to lease it or buy out the lease or sell it or anything like that. And I actually believe that because I work for a school, and trying to sell things is really kind of a weird pain, politically speaking. But anyway, they a friend who knows a friend who knows a friend happened to hook us up with Pentagon computers, so we are getting 180 Pentium 4 computers with a gig of RAM and 3.2 gig processor donated to our school. And our school is, of course, in horrible economic shape. So this is a really awesome thing. And the coolest part, they all come with declassified stickers all over them. So it's like we have X-File computers, man.
That's awesome. This is really cool.
So, yeah, it just made me think of it because I got to play with it yesterday. Because when there's no students and no teachers around, I get to just have fun at school. And so I got to play with one of these new computers.
Well, plus if you have like 180 of them when they're idle, I mean, that's like that's a lot of SETI at home or a lot of folding proteins or whatever you want to do with them.
That's true. You know, years ago in my nefarious youth, I actually did have every computer in our district at nighttime instead of shutting off and saving electricity like a good steward of taxpayer money. I cranked those babies on SETI. So, yeah, the group of Sean had quite a daily output of SETI hunting. But anyway, this week or this month is the embedded issue. We have a bunch of articles. Let's get right to it. The first one that I'm going to talk about is actually a really freaky article. Maybe not freaky, but the pictures are pretty scary. And I can't.
It's scary to me.
Yeah, I kind of might have nightmares about it. Cool nightmares, I hope. But the article is Hexapod, a Linux powered spider robot, and it's an interview that is done by Anton Borisov, and it's interviewing the guy who created this Hexapod robot. And Hexapod, how many legs do you think it has, Kyle?
I would say at least 20.
Yeah, we are not math majors. No. but it's a six-legged spider-looking thing with a webcam on the front, and it's Linux powered. And this article is really cool. It's actually an interview with the guy who developed it. The guy's name, Matt Bunting, he developed this Hexapod, and it goes through the process of how he did it. It shows early prototypes where it's just a bunch of servos and stuff. But this is a Linux-powered spider robot that really looks like it could take over the world. It's pretty freaky and really cool.
Well, it sort of reminds me, have you seen those videos of the quadricopters that are autonomous?
Yeah.
They're doing all kinds of scary, messed up Skynet stuff. I mean, this is like looking at those pictures. And actually, one of the things I really like about this article is at the end, he has some sample code to find Sarah Connor, which is, you know, you don't get that in a lot of other articles that you'll find in literature when you get sample code. But yeah, I mean, this is like some creepy, weird. I mean, it's really cool. Don't get me wrong. But it's also scary. I mean, between that and the quadricopter, they could take over the world.
That's true. Now, did you ever watch Stargate SG-1? Were you a Stargate fan?
Is that the one with MacGyver in it?
Yeah, the one with MacGyver in it, yeah.
Well, I saw an episode. I think Bill made me watch an episode of that.
Okay, well, later seasons, one of the big main bad guys was the Replicators, and the original form of the Replicators were little spider robots, and this is exactly, I mean, this really reminds me of the Replicators from Stargate SG-1. So they were really creepy bad guys that were hard to kill. So yeah, I'm probably going to have nightmares tonight now that I think about it. So, yeah.
Man, thanks. Like little tiny, yeah.
Yeah, they're freaky.
Little tiny robotic bugs going around. So, like, oh, speaking of bugs and especially debugging, which we really want to do when you have, like, these hexapod bug robots crawling around. So the article I'm going to talk about is debugging embedded Linux platforms with GDB and Python. You like what I did there? That was...
going to debug the Stargate spaceship. Yeah, way to go.
Nice. Yes. Patting myself on the back. So this is by Tom Parkin. And basically what this goes over, if you've done any kind of C programming in the past, and if you're doing embedded development, you probably have to do at least some of this. So when you're trying to debug C program, now, of course, for me, I never got sophisticated enough in my programming where I was debugging with GDB. I was mostly just debugging with print statements, which is still perfectly valid, I think. But anyway, so when you start getting in more sophisticated with your debugging, you actually want to do a little bit more than you can with the print statement, and that's where GDB comes in. Well, what this article talks about is it first sort of talks about how the approach to debugging embedded programs and sort of the problems that come into play. And then what this article is really about, though, is the fact that, you know, GDB is great, but it can be a little clunky when you're trying to set up an environment to sort of efficiently debug processes. So what the article does is he talks about how to use a Python API on top of GDB so that you can run embedded processes on an embedded platform and then output that. And there's actually even a GDB server, which I didn't really even realize there's like this client server model with GDB, which is something I learned in the article. But basically, you could run this GDB server along with the process you want to debug. And then on a client that's, you know, running your maybe a regular Linux desktop, connect to that and step through your program and debug it. But in this case, he's actually giving examples of how to use Python for that, because instead of having to walk through like that, he gives examples of Python scripts that you can use to automate that process. So if you're having to debug embedded MIPC code on, you know, some sort of ARM processor, it can be a little clunky, but with this, you can, if you know Python, which a lot of people nowadays, it's a really popular language, you can use that plus GDB, and it looks like it makes it a lot more automated.
Right, because GDB, yeah, it's been around forever, but it's kind of, like you said, it's difficult to use. Python makes things as easy as chewing gum. Speaking of which, now that's how you do a segue, my friend. Speaking of which... my next article is actually by James McCall, and it's Breaking Free the Gumsticks DSP. Now, we've done articles before about Gumsticks computers, and I've never actually used one myself, but they're fascinating because they're so ridiculously small, about the size and shape of a stick of gum. Now, what's unique about this article is he's not just talking about programming the Gumsticks, but I didn't realize this new Gumstick thing actually has three processors on it. It has the ARM processor for normal, you know, running the kernel and doing regular things. It has the PowerVR chipset, and plus it has a digital signal processor as well. And that's really what he goes into. This is something that isn't normally taken advantage of, but for doing math type stuff, this DSP processor is something that you can really take advantage of on a computer system as small as a stick of gum. And he goes through, and I'll be quite honest, embedded programming is not my forte, but he goes through the whole process of how you actually not only compile a kernel specifically for the Gumsticks, but then how you take advantage of that DSP processor for things like doing Fourier transforms and all that kind of really awesome geeky math stuff. So it's really a good look at the three different processors on this tiny little computer and how you take advantage of those in tiny embedded space.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, I mean, the thing about the Gumsticks is it reminds me a lot of, you know, I know that they've actually predate, as far as I know, the Arduino and the TI Launchpad. It's kind of like a similar platform where they have a lot of different modules you can choose from that have different capabilities. It's kind of interesting to see one that, like, perfect examples of how to use this really teeny tiny platform with DSP programming. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, it really is.
Yeah, so
makes me speechless.
Sorry, I was getting ready to say I'm at a loss for words, but if only I had, you know. So, which leads me to my next article. So, next article I'm going to talk about is Speech.io for embedded applications, and this is by Rick Rogers. It, basically, what this talks about is some of the challenges and how to work with speech applications. Well, like I said, in embedded environments. But so a lot of actually have done a little bit of work with text to speech stuff. So I've in the past I've messed a little bit with Festival, messed around with Festival, and I wrote a little wrapper around it at one point because I wanted to take like a lot of the Project Gutenberg books and read them audibly to myself. But the problem was, you know, if you just pipe an audiobook, or not an audiobook, you pipe a Project Gutenberg book straight to Festival, it doesn't really work that well. So I took, I basically wrote a little script that wrapped around the book and it would identify where paragraphs were and question marks and things like that, and parse it in such a way that when it fed it to Festival, it sounded a little bit better than if you just piped an entire book to it. Yeah. Plus, I also like doing like a, love British accents with Festival. It's almost like a butler or something. I don't know what that is, but I just think it's like really awesome to do Festival with a British accent. Anyway, this article is not about British accents. What it's about is he talks about just sort of an introduction to the two sides of speech recognition, or so like text to speech. So taking, you know, something I'm typing and convert that to text or to speech that's, that you can obviously hear, and then doing the opposite, taking some sort of speech and then converting that into text or into something that a program can understand. And so he talks sort of overall introduction to that. Then he talks about how you would get that working on an embedded platform. So, I mean, when I first thought about it, I was like, well, I'm not even sure how you would do this because embedded platforms, you know, are not that powerful, I wouldn't think. And so it seems like it would be really challenging to fit something as powerful as speech recognition on something that's small. But he gives some examples of some – I guess these days even embedded processors are pretty powerful. So he talks about some of the options you have, like eSpeak, which is a package that you can even get with Ubuntu and other things, and then Flight, which is an embedded version of Festival, which is what I had used in the past. He talks about how to use eSpeak and how to use something called Pocket Sphinx, which is a speaker recognition software, and how to use that with an ARM Cortex-A8, which is 800 megahertz. It's actually the same processor that's in an N900,
wow.
Or at least similar. Yeah. So it's like pretty fast, actually, 512 megabytes of RAM and all that stuff. So pretty fast machine, and he talks about how to develop a like speech recognition software that you could use. In his case, he actually gives an example of like a surgery checklist, which is kind of crazy because you start thinking about some of the applications for embedded programming, it become pretty serious. So like a safe surgery checklist, making sure that like it when it's the right patient and the site where you're going to do the surgery is marked and all this stuff is kind of crazy. But then he walks through like basically sample code again. That's one thing nice about this issue is there's a lot of sample code to demonstrate these points, but he basically talks about how to at least get started on the road for doing speech recognition in an embedded platform.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to admit, text-to-speech is also kind of a hobby of mine, and not so much making it happen, although I've used Festival a lot for the same kind of reasons. It's actually, I didn't know that you played with that as well, but I have as well. And then the Kindle came out, and the Kindle will do text-to-speech, and surprisingly well. I know a lot of people are down on the whole computer reading a book, but I find that a lot of times I don't have time to actually stop and read a book, but I have time to multitask and listen to a book. So if I don't have an audiobook, I will just, you know, like let the Kindle read to me or have the computer read to me. And, yeah, that's pretty cool. It is a neat article. And like you said, embedded devices are becoming so powerful. I mean, you know, it's just – it is fascinating to see the things that they can do.
Yeah.
So – that's it. I do want to do a – there is an article. We normally mention just the four, but there is an article this month by a friend of mine, so I wanted to mention that. Adrian Hanna has his first article. It's a primer on the OAuth protocol, so be sure to check that out. It's kind of cool. It's great to see a familiar name in between the covers of Linux Journal. And speaking of looking at the – no, that was a horrible segue. I'm just not going to do a segue for this one. Kyle, I'm sitting here at my desk, and we're on separate sides of the continent. I'm curious, on your desk, are you a multiple monitor kind of guy, or are you a single monitor kind of guy?
So I prefer multiple monitors, but at home, so for the longest time at home, since I've moved into the house that I'm living in now, I don't really have an office of my own. So when I use my computer, I'm usually sitting on the couch with my laptop. So without an office, even though I really like having multiple monitors, over the last couple of years, I've really just stuck to my laptop monitor. But now when I'm in front of a desk, like, for example, at work, I love multiple monitors. I mean, there's nothing better than to have, I mean, more screen real estate, the better, as far as I'm concerned. How about you?
I like to have multiple monitors. I find that sometimes it doesn't fit the situation. I mean, I don't have enough desk space, or I don't have enough monitors. But here's another thing that bothers me about it. You really hit the nail on the head, and I was going to say I just like to have a lot of pixels, whether it's one big or several smaller. You know, I guess I prefer one big over several, like, 17-inch monitors. But you know what's really bothering me is monitors now that you buy at the store or online, they're starting to have, like, all these, oh, buy a 29-inch monitor, and they're, like, 1080p. I don't understand. Who are they fooling with these ridiculously low-resolution and large inch-wise monitors? I don't understand that.
Yeah, it's like getting a TV, you know. Like that's the thing, is a lot of people want to use TVs as monitors, and it's neat and all until you realize how low-res it really is for a screen that big.
Yeah, you know, exactly right. Like, oh, I could use my 12-inch laptop or my 42-inch screen and have the exact same number of pixels. It's a big pet peeve of mine. I'm seeing, like, a 30-inch monitor, and 30-inch monitor used to mean some serious pixel resolution. But now, if you go on, you're like, oh, look, I can get a 30-inch monitor for, like, $350. But you got to look close, because that $350 30-inch monitor is just like a high-def TV. It's lame. So that's a pet peeve of mine.
Yeah. For me, the thing I've just recently, and maybe other people have done this for a while, but the thing I just recently discovered based on my new job is a lot of people did. When I first joined this, I noticed a lot of people had this setup, and I mimicked it. And it's basically using a high-res monitor and portrait mode for terminals only.
What was that? You broke up.
Oh, sorry. So what I've noticed is a lot of people that were using a high-def monitor only in portrait mode. And specifically in portrait mode for terminal use. So I started using that, and I tell you, I'm a convert now. I mean, I don't see, at least in my day job, how I could get by without it. Basically, what I have is a nice 1080p, like, maybe, I forget how big the monitor is, but a good-sized monitor, completely vertical, and then I just have a bunch of terminals, and I actually have one giant screen session that I can split vertically as many times as I want. It's not a big deal. Or if I want to view an entire man page, it just fills up the screen. It's easy to read documents and stuff. I'm sold. I think that's if I ever get an office here at home, definitely how I'm going to set things up.
You know, I did have 22-inch monitors in portrait mode on each side of my main monitor for a while. The one thing, you have to have a monitor that's set to do that, or have some way to mount it securely in portrait mode. The other thing is, it's really good if the monitor is made for it, because sometimes the viewing angles get really messed up if you put something in portrait mode that was never meant to be that way.
Well, the other thing... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that can really mess you up. You just have to be careful if you're using it.
Well, something I discovered is that there's actually not a whole lot of good support. I noticed a couple bugs in different desktop environments. So, for instance, Compiz, if you want to use Compiz, and I had an NVIDIA driver, so I had all this stuff set up, you can't... They don't really very well support having one monitor be in portrait mode and one monitor be in landscape mode.
Really?
If you would think it would be a no-brainer, but if you want to use that plus all the Compiz Fusion, if you want your windows to catch on fire when you close them and all that good stuff, then you can actually do it you can have two portrait mode or two landscape mode, but you can't have one of each. It's like there's a bug that's been filed about it, but it's something you can't do. So for me to do it, had to turn off Compiz Fusion effects and all that stuff, and had to go to almost like an X to X. One way to do it is like old school X to X mode, which didn't really fly. But there's like, I basically had to turn on Zenorama and disable a lot of the cool effects so that I could have one portrait and one landscape. It's really weird.
You know, I never thought about it, but when I was doing it, I was at work, and so I had multiple operating systems. And, you know, my Linux box was in portrait mode, but it didn't have multiple monitors. I was just using, like, Synergy, you know, to go between computers.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess I've never had a Linux box that had both a portrait and a landscape. It was either or in my setup. So that's really good to know.
Yeah, I mean, even, like I said, the fancy pants NVIDIA's, you know, proprietary software with their nice little wizard that you can configure 50 other, like, incredibly technical video things about this graphics card, but not, it couldn't handle this, so it's really weird.
That is bizarre. All right. Well, hey, Kyle, I appreciate, again, this month doing the podcast with you. And I'd like to thank everybody for listening to the Linux Journal Insider for the June 2011 issue. Make sure to pick up a copy on newsstands in mid-May. And subscribers, if you're listening to this, you already have a copy in your hands, or it's on its way. We hope you enjoy. Next month is actually one of my favorite issues. It's the Cool Projects issue. So make sure to tune in again, and don't forget to visit us at www.linuxjournal.com. Hey, Kyle, talk to you again in a month.
Talk to you next time.